how the applause going. Welcome to It Just So Happens. I am Richard Paulsford, stand-up comedian and rather unprofessional historian. In this show, recorded for the It Just So Happened podcast, we will explore some of the historical people associated with and events which happened on this very day in history, which is the 5th of August. That's before we delve into some of the history of the place where today's show is taking place. So, where are we? It's the city which Time Out magazine last year rated the best in the world. Yes, it's Edinburgh. We are performing today as part of the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, the largest annual international arts festival in the world. And our venue this morning is the Hill Street Theatre. Situated in Edinburgh's New Town, this historic A-listed building dates back to the 1820s. In 1893, it was purchased by the Masonic Lodge of Edinburgh, Mary's Chapel No. 1, so called because the lodge first met within the old chapel of St. Mary's on Nidris Wynd in Edinburgh, and is designated No. 1 on the roll of lodges of the Grand Lodge of Scotland, as it possesses the oldest existing minute of any Masonic lodge still operating, dating back to 1599, and the first historical reference of a Freemason being initiated as a member in 1634. Making it likely to be the oldest Masonic lodge, not only in Scotland, but the world. The building has also been used as a fringe venue for the past 37 years, which makes it the oldest fringe venue constantly in operation. Fittingly, we have an audience with us today, as the fringe welcomes audiences of up to 400,000 people each year, so we welcome about 1/100,000th of that number. What's drawn in such huge numbers? Well, let me introduce today's panel. Please welcome Paul Connolly, Epi Brilliant, and Tasha Mutt. So, Paul, first, you're an Edinburgh-based actor and improviser, most notable for your work with TBC Improv, Absolute Improv, Spontaneous Potter. When not thrilling crowds with wondrous performances as a Wizard of Phoenix, you can be found... This is his next to me. Paul can often be found trying to prove double denim is cool.
I mean, there's no proving required, right?
Canadian tuxedo.
And your favourite anecdote would be...
My favourite anecdote? Yeah,
about a place.
About
in America.
A place. Oh!
Yeah.
So I visit New York a lot, and because I've got family over there. And I am often telling various stories about times when I was in New York, and it's a running gag on the improv scene where I'll start saying something about New York and people go, oh, you've been to New York? And now that I've told you, I feel like now if I say a New York story, you're all going to go, oh, wait, have you been to New York?
So we shall see. Thank you. Epi Brilliant is a musical comedian who combines traditional folk music with surreal, silly, and thought-provoking themes. Rooted in the folk traditions of Northeast England, Epi creates unique compositions drawing on their life experiences in the LGBTQ+ community, the challenges of living with ADHD, and the working class upbringing.
Hello, yeah, that's right. Yeah. So yes, I am a musical comedian. Or my parents were set unemployed.
And Tasha, I don't have a lot about you. I know that you live in Edinburgh and you lay claim to being the youngest comedian on the Scottish comedy circuit.
Yeah, brilliant.
So straight over to you, Paul, please, for your On This Day piece.
Wonderful. So the topic I wanted to talk about was a show called Whose Line Is It Anyway, which was a very important show for those of us on the improv comedy scene. So on this day in 1998, the American version debuted on ABC. So as a little bit of backstory for Whose Line Is It Anyway, for anybody who's not as familiar with it, it was a very long-running improv show in which performers would do these improv games, act out, and create on the spot different characters, stories, and just thrill audiences of all ages. It got its start in 1987 when two men, Dan Patterson and Mark Levison, went to the BBC with a pitch for a new improv-style show based on a thing called theatre sports, which is these short games. And the BBC were willing to go with, did you take a chance on it? Which is something they're not as willing to do these days, but they gave a 6-episode run on Radio 4. And the original lineup was Clive Anderson, who was the host, John Sessions, Stephen Fry, they were the two regulars, and then a rotating cast of other performers, including people like Don French, Rory Bremner, a lot of these individuals. After it had this 6-episode run on Radio 4, they wanted to take it to TV, so they approached the BBC again about taking it to TV. The BBC, they hummed and hawed over it, they weren't really sure, so then they approached Channel 4. And Channel 4 being the young, energetic channel, they were immediately, yep, we're going to go for that. There was one slight hitch, though, in that Stephen Fry had actually grown to not really enjoy improv comedy after doing the radio show, so then it was a question of what were they going to do with it, but he agreed to let them do the show, and he would appear on one episode of the first season. John Sessions would remain as a regular in the first season, Clive Anderson would be the host. And so it started on Channel 4 in 1988. And during its time on Channel 4, it was really a launching pad for a lot of different improvised comedians. They had some established people on there, but also a lot of the Comedy Store Players, which is a London-based comedy venue, Comedy Store, and it's their improv troupe there. So people like Paul Merton, Josie Lawrence, Richard Branch, Sandy Toksvig, they all would appear on the show and they were part of the Comedy Store Players. And also, as an aside note, one of the founding members of the Comedy Store Players was a guy called Mike Myers, pre-Saturday Night Live, Shrek, Austin Powers, all that kind of stuff. He was one of the people who helped set that up. So there you go, a little extra bonus fact there for you. And over the years, Whose Line has, as I said, entertained thrilled audiences. The original run on the BBC ran from 1988 until 1998. And during that time, a lot of American performers came in, including people like Ryan Stiles and Colin Mochrie. And then eventually in 98, it got cancelled in the UK, it got picked up in America. And so it ran from 98 until, not reading off my notes at all, 98 until 2007, and then it got picked up again 2013 until this year. Although it turns out, so as a researcher for this, I found out that apparently there's a little bit of uncertainty as to whether it's going to continue. So there is another season of it planned, but Colin Mochrie kind of went on the social media to explain that actually they've not been getting paid good residuals, and there is some doubt as to whether it's going to continue afterwards, which unfortunately, yes, the issues of paying performers and paying actors what they're worth is still problematic. Pay your actors, pay your performers. This is a political movement. Let's move on with this. I think I yield my time.
thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
I'm going to do first of two on this day segue pieces myself here. So, questions to the panel. Which ship left Southampton on this day in 1620, transporting pilgrims to the New World?
Mayflower.
Hey, Mayflower. Right,
straight in there. It should be funny with these.
No, it's to win. We are trying to win this. It's entirely up to you, Effie. The voyage of Mayflower is well known, but there was a second sister ship called Speedwell, which also left at the same time, but didn't make it to America. So, what happened to Speedwell?
Ooh, they got lost and went somewhere they thought was American and wasn't.
Fair answer.
It's a guess.
I went to go see the Titanic.
did they get confused and instead of going across the water, they just went back on themselves and got stuck on land?
That sounds entirely plausible. Actually, it developed a leak. And so it had to be refitted at Dartmouth. And after further leaks, which was possibly due to sabotage, Mayflower made the 60-day crossing alone. Mm. The Embarkation of the Pilgrims is a painting by Robert Walter Weir. It was commissioned by the United States Congress and depicts the pilgrims on board Speedwell while harboured in Delft, Holland. This is depicted on what?
Probably like a biscuit tin? Like, I feel like there must be at least one biscuit tin. Yeah, well, like little ship-shaped biscuits.
They do tea towels in America, I'm not sure.
They must do a tea. They probably call it a coffee towel because they don't drink tea. Yeah.
It is depicted on the reverse of the $10,000 bill. familiar with.
Matt Walsh.
It was issued in 1918. Only five are known to be in existence, all held in institutional collections. So, what was the first English colony in North America, and when was it established?
Is that Jamestown?
It was.
16-something, early 16-something.
I'm going to say 1609.
1617.
Oh!
1611.
1607. So, quite impressive. Yeah, Jamestown was the first permanent colony in what is now the United States. However, it could be argued that the first colony was established when Sir Humphrey Gilbert landed on Newfoundland at what is now St. John's on the 3rd of August 1583. What had led to this expedition? Bit of a vague question. But what prompted the English to go over to North America?
They just fancied a day trip.
Yeah. They needed some leather jackets and sunglasses.
Yeah.
They're English.
Spain had long since laid claim to much of South and Central America, so by the 1570s and 1580s, Queen Elizabeth I granted royal permission to Englishmen to colonise North America. Even then, Gilbert was by no means the first European to arrive at Newfoundland. There had been Portuguese, French and Spanish, all been there in the previous 90 years or so. Do we know anything about Sir Humphrey Gilbert? Given he was the first Englishman over there, you'd think he'd be quite famous.
I think he was knighted.
He was. Sir Humphrey was, yes.
a bit of a hunchback as well, I think.
He was MP for Plymouth and then Queenborough in Kent. He was also a soldier, an adventurer, and an explorer. His Latin mottos were said to be quid non, which means why not, and mutare vel timere sperno, which means I scorn to change or to fear. 2 days after landing, Gilbert took possession on the 5th day of August 1583 of this new found land in the name of his sovereign Queen Elizabeth. Although no permanent base was established, this was the start of Britain's overseas empire. Hurrah! What other famous explorer do you think Sir Humphrey Gilbert might have been related to?
Is it Francis Bacon? Is that the artist I'm thinking of?
No, that's the artist.
There's somebody called Francis something, right?
Correct.
There we go.
It's actually someone else. It's another sir.
Oh.
Sir,
I'll say Captain Cook, because he's from Middlesbrough, and that's where I'm from.
Sir Captain Cook.
Sir Walter Raleigh.
That makes more sense.
So why is Sir Humphrey Gilbert largely forgotten, and yet we remember Sir Walter Raleigh, or know his name at least? So shall I tell you?
Please.
Gilbert had three unsuccessful attempts to establish a colony in America, to the extent that Queen Elizabeth doubted his seafaring abilities. And he was promptly lost at sea while returning home from the Newfoundland trip on 9th of September 1583, which kind of proves the point. So the following year, Elizabeth granted a patent to Walter Raleigh, transferring Gilbert's rights to a large swathe of land on America's east coast, so that's why we remember Raleigh and not Gilbert. The town of St. John's was only established as a permanent community sometime after 1630, because the West Country fishing industry in England urged the government to forbid the establishment of a permanent settlement along the English-controlled coast. So, there we go. Straight over to you now,
Thank you. So today I wanted to talk about the world's best wedding band, and that's the Beatles. On this day, on the 5th of August 1966, they released Revolver. No one's favourite Beatles album, it's a good one. The reason I say that is because there was no real hits on that album. They only released one single, it was a double A-side, and that was Eleanor Rigby and Yellow Submarine, and they only did Yellow Submarine to stop Ringo from asking to do a song. The working title was actually After Geography. That's another great thing the Beatles, Ringo brought to the Beatles, is great ideas like that. Which is, it's the greatest pun ever. It's a pun on the Rolling Stones title Aftermath. Clever, innit? Good old Ringo. My favourite Beatle is actually the Volkswagen Mark I. That's the one Hitler built. I've just got this thing for closeted men who won't be dead. The first track on Revolver is Taxman, and that goes na 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 Taxman, Taxman, Taxman. It doesn't actually go like that. That was a little joke. It goes like this: bam 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 bam. There we go. But yeah, one critic described that song as like a prototype for the punk movement. I don't really agree with that. I mean, a really rich man complaining about his taxes doesn't feel very punk. I don't remember the class singing about like the advantages of deregulated free markets. Yeah, I don't remember that. I really don't remember that. The summer this was released was also the same summer that John Lennon said the Beatles were bigger than Jesus. I never understood this because obviously the Beatles grew up with industrialised farming. They would have been so much taller than Jesus. Like a good few fuss, probably, yeah. And while we're on that, the Vatican actually claimed that Revolver was their favourite album of the Vatican, which is a bit strange, isn't it? Really, knowing that they're big Beatles fans really puts a different spin on the line. She was just 17. I know, I was worried about that one. You've got to laugh, though, you've got to laugh. we've got another page, we're nearly done. Tomorrow Never Knows, this was like the first song to ever use like proper looping and like sound audio mixing. So what they did is they like recorded the drums and paid them backwards to make that like crazy drum loop. And what it also means is that John Lennon only needs to be really arrogant once and they can just repeat it over the record. Another great thing about the Beatles is, and they can predict the future, I think, like Got to Get You Into My Life is actually about air fryers. So you all got one. Fucking amazing. Love it. Love it. I got one with better anywhere. Talk to me about it afterwards. Ray Davies wasn't really a fan. He said the album was a bit rubbish, which I think is a bit harsh considering. I often think of the Kinks. Ray Davies was the lead singer with the Kinks. The Kinks are like the ugly sister of the Beatles. So if you think of like Lasagna and Moussaka, they're both lovely, but you know which one's nicer. And if we're going down that analogy, you've also got the Beach Boys, who are more like the cousin who went away to uni and just came back different. And that's it for me. Thank you. I will continue.
Thank you. So my second segue piece. When was the first cinema opened in the UK?
1906.
1584. 1882.
All right, so you were closest. So it's the 5th of August today in 1901. So early cine films were shown in music halls, theatres and even private homes. In fact, anywhere that had seats and suitable space. Cinema was seen as a novelty, but that all changed with the opening of dedicated cinemas. The days of music hall as popular entertainment were numbered as the first half of the 20th century came to be dominated by screenings in cinemas. Where do you think the first cinema was in the UK?
Slough.
Slough, Edinburgh.
I feel like it's probably some like random small town in England, but I don't know any small random towns. So I'm going to say Willesby. I hope that's a small town.
Well, it was a small town called London.
I told you.
It was in Islington. So the Beaux Arts style agricultural hall in Islington had been built in 1869 and was used as a concert hall before it became the base for the American Mohawk Minstrels show. On the 3rd of August 1900, the theatre showed its first film. The film shows were so successful that the building was dedicated solely to cinema, opening on this day 122 years ago. Silent films were accompanied by a piano and 15-piece orchestra, who were known as the Phonobion. So, little stats sort of guess here. What do you think was the average weekly cinema attendance in Britain at the height of cinema's popularity, which is in the 1940s? So how many people went every week, do you think, to the cinema?
I'd say in the millions.
Yeah.
I don't know what the British population was, but
it must be pretty much everybody.
Yeah, so I'm gonna say like 30 million.
More than
10?
There's at least 10 people in the cinema.
I'm not wrong.
We're about to find out. Do you want to guess? Are you just saying millions? Or?
Yeah, no, I would say. I think 30 is a good guess. Let's go 20 million. I'm going to
the middle.
Well,
okay. You were actually completely correct. It's 30
really?
Million. Yeah. Which is quite a staggering thing.
What
was
the
population? Someone's applauding, so I'll take that while you can. Yeah, that's a staggering figure when you think about it. And as you say, the population wasn't as great as it is today. Final question, what do you think, you know, this being the UK, well, first question, when do you think the first cinema closed and what do you think happened to it, this being the UK?
Well, presumably it closed about 5-6 o'clock.
Good answer. What year do you think it closed?
Well, 1901, after 5 or 6 o'clock.
Yeah. I'm going to, maybe like the 20, 1920?
In the 1920s, okay.
Maybe it was
even earlier, but I'm going to say 1920.
Yeah. When did the first one that opened actually close?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it could still be open, I would have thought.
It could still be open.
Yeah, I'll go still be open. But considering you said they closed because we're in Britain, I'm thinking someone complained, the tea was rubbish, or it burned down.
Yeah, not bad. So it closed. It closed in 1963, so that kind of ties in with a bit of the decline of cinema, I guess. It became a bingo hall, which I think is quite a UK thing. In 1975, it was closed and the building was demolished in 1985, which again is just, you know, history, who needs that?
We've got so much here, haven't we? We've got enough history here. Yeah,
so that's the end of my second segue piece, and it's over to you, Tasha, now. Thank you.
Hi, so I didn't realise, I was wondering what history, how far I'd have to go in the past, and then I thought history is everything that isn't now. So I've gone 10 years in the past with lab-grown burgers were invented in 2013. I wasn't very confident about this topic because I was worried that everyone else was going to be doing some really, really smart, like 1900s, using all these long words that I don't know existed. And I was going to be walking on going, yeah, guys, so lab-grown burgers exist. And I'm going to really, really annoy you all by saying, when I was researching this, I realised that 2013 is a decade ago, which is more than half my lifetime ago. Rub that in, and I'm going to pause and let you guys think about that. So they were invented in the Netherlands on the 5th of August 2013 by extracting the stem cells from cows and turning them in little petri dishes to burgers. Bearing in mind that Dolly the Sheep, which is an entire sheep, cost half a million to make, this project in its entirety was £250,000 for a 3-inch in diameter burger to be created, which, to be fair, in 2023, not that far off from Weekly Shop. Bit dramatic for 2013. Maybe they didn't have the excuse of Liz Truss, to be fair. So I was kind of a bit disappointed when I was reading these articles because I assumed for some reason it'd be vegan. I'm not vegan myself. I was just genuinely upset. Don't know why I thought it would be vegan. Just pull it out of midair. There we go, burger. But yeah, as I said, comes from stem cells from cows. And they had to have, basically, they had to have this whole campaign explaining that it was a good thing that we are creating fake meat from, well, what is essentially fake meat from these stem cells from cows, because it is reducing the farming land that would be necessary to create the same amount of burger. As someone who used to work on a farm, this kind of got me thinking, I feel really bad for the poor, poor souls that they expected to extract stem cells from hundreds of cows in the name of 3 inches of meat. We've all been there. So obviously this was a pretty difficult thing to advertise to the public because people thought that this was going to catch on. God knows why. So I'm going to really stress before I read out these quotes that they were advertising this to the world. They were wanting people to eat these. Direct quote from the BBC. With how the whole thing worked, obviously, they would interview the researchers, and the researchers said that stem cells would be extracted from cows to create muscle strips and then formed into patties. Don't know about you guys, but I love nothing more than a roast, right? Especially if my mum makes it, so you get like the nostalgia points for it. You get broccoli, carrots, stuffing, especially the special recipe for muscle strips. But yeah, as well as the muscle strips that were contained, they had beetroot juice. So we have the authentic blood secretion we all know and love. Because if we were making something like this, we would want to take out all of the horrible parts and all of the things that put people off, right? And also they had breadcrumbs, caramel, and saffron. So at least now we know why it cost $250,000 to make. And yeah, so as the researchers were trying to tell everyone to eat this Frankenburger that they'd produced, their exact words were, "It does not taste great." Direct quote. "But it is good enough." Yeah, I laughed at that, to be honest. So then, when everything was produced, they had this whole thing in America, where they had all of the burgers that they'd made, and they cut it up into little bits, and they were giving them to the public to try out, because presumably that would give them some, you know, good first customers. And the exact quotes from people who tried it were, "It's okay," to "It could be cheaper," to "It is disgusting." So yeah, it never caught on.
Thank you. I just expressed my relief that having done the advance, you were going to be talking about a subject that was 3 inches of meat. I wasn't quite sure where it was going, but sorry, it's a bit early for that. But we'll right, so move on to the second half of the show, which is the history of Edinburgh. Can I just get a show of hands to the audience who's from Edinburgh or knows a lot about Edinburgh? Okay, so excuse our ignorance if we discover something about Edinburgh. Lots of questions for the panel on the first subject, which is Edinburgh's hills. So many cities in the world claim to be built on seven hills, including Edinburgh. Can you name some of the others? There were loads, and I don't have the exhaustive list, but can you think of any others?
Is it other cities?
Other cities in the world who claim to be built on seven hills.
I feel like there must be somewhere like Mexico, right? Because they have those.
Possibly, so that's not on my list.
Was that in Kiwanis of the mountain in Peru?
Come on, I've gone for easy countries. I've just
France.
Somewhere in Europe.
There are some in Europe, yes.
Great. Switzerland must have one.
Oh, yes. Oh, Italy? Italy?
Okay, right. I think your list is going to be different to mine. So let me just say. So there's Jerusalem, Athens, Prague in Europe, Tehran, also in America, San Francisco, Washington DC, and Seven Hills, Ohio, the clue's in the name, and also Kiev, interestingly. Now, what are the seven hills which Edinburgh is supposedly built on? So I'm probably going to rely more on Paul here, but can we test your knowledge?
Oh, you're testing my knowledge. So you've got Pentlands?
No,
because as I said, you've got Castle Rock?
Yeah.
Carlton Hill?
Yeah.
Arthur's Seat?
Yeah.
Is Salisbury Crags a separate one?
No, that's included within Arthur's Seat.
Blackford Hill?
Yes.
Jimmy's Hill?
Do you know Tasha? How local are you?
I'm local 40 miles away.
So I'll tell you what the other three are.
Go on.
So there's Braid Hill, Castorfin, and the Craig Lockett.
I didn't know those.
You've got more than 50%, so. Arthur's Seat is a hill just to the east of Edinburgh city centre, 822 feet above sea level, which is in fact an ancient volcanic plug. The lava has been dated to about 340 million years old. Panel, how do you think Arthur's Seat got its name?
I mean, I imagine somebody went, "I want to call this Arthur's Seat." That's how it got its name.
I had to Google this. I found two different things. So either a guy called Sir Arthur said, "This is now my hill," which, fair enough. It would have been funny if I went through this, if I went through a newly built city and I found a hill that didn't have a name, I'd say, "Well, that's Tasha Hill now." Or it could be the Gaelic word, similar to a Gaelic word for the height of arrows, which I think is the more exciting version of some bloke just walked past and went, "That's my hill now."
Yeah, exactly. So congratulations on your successful Google search. Indeed, yes. How did the nearby cliffs known as Salisbury Crags, which you just mentioned, how did they form? So getting into a bit of geology here.
Well, the Ice Age, I imagine, the movement of matter, because that's how you get Castle Rock, right? It's that slowing down the sediment and then that's how you got that trail. So I imagine the Tolkien craft goes something similar, where it's the rocks, it's going by there.
Yes, it's the action of a glacier which moved from west to east during the past 2 million years and took material along with it. So he's in the Rocky Crags. Right, very, very specialist subject now. So the father of modern geology, James Hutton, was informed by the local geology. He advanced the idea that the physical world's remote history can be inferred from evidence in present-day rocks. In a particular area of the Salisbury Crags known as Hutton's Section, he observed that the magma had forced its way through the sedimentary rocks above it and formed the rock formations there. And that helped him develop the theory that geological features are not static, but undergo continuing transformation over extremely long periods of time. And from this, he argued that the Earth could not be young. So, more than 6,000 years old, which is what a lot of people were saying at the time. So, next question. How is Edinburgh's monument called the National Monument to the Fallen of the Napoleonic Wars, better known? frantically looks at notes.
No, I can answer this one.
So it's known as Edinburgh's Disgrace. It's the half-finished monument on Carlton Hill, the National Monument to the Fallen of the Napoleonic Wars.
Is that what that's called?
It's one of its monikers, yeah. It's known as a few different things, but Edinburgh's Disgrace.
Oh, no, Edinburgh's Disgrace, I definitely knew that one.
Oh, sorry.
I
didn't know the National Monument to the Fallen of the Napoleonic Wars, yeah. You can see why it's not easy to say. So yes, it's existed in a half-finished state since the 1820s. The foundation stone weighs 6 tons and was laid in 1822 by George IV. I don't think he did it personally, but that's what it says. The plans for a memorial of the past and incentive to the future heroism of the men of Scotland was drawn up by William Playfair and was designed to emulate the appearance of the Parthenon on the Athenian Acropolis, but operate as a church and have catacombs underneath. Why the Parthenon in Edinburgh?
Well, because Edinburgh was the Athens of the North, and that's like the Enlightenment time, I think, was when that's all happening, so I assume that's the reason?
It is. So the leading man behind the campaign for this monument was Thomas Bruce, the 7th Earl of Elgin. And what's he better known for? The clues in the Elgin bit.
He founded Elgin.
He might have done, don't know.
Well, what is an Elgin?
So Elgin's a place.
Oh, right.
I believe
it's
in Murray, towards the north coast of Scotland.
Sorry, very exhausted. Yeah, very exhausted.
He's most famous for the Elgin marbles, which were the stolen, can we call them stolen, monuments. So yeah, so he was involved in this monument in Edinburgh. How much money do you think was required to build this new monument? This is in 1822.
I'm going to go with my previous way of guessing by more than £10.
It was cheaper than a burger, I can tell you that.
is that in like today's money or is it money at the time?
Money at the time.
Money at the time. Yeah, I'll say something like £50,000.
Yeah, approximately. So £42,000 needed to be raised by public subscription to pay for it. And construction work went ahead in 1826, even though only one third of the amount had been raised. So huge blocks of stone were hauled in from Craigleith Quarry, which is fairly local, but still a bit of a schlep. And they finished the base and 12 columns before the project was abandoned because they just didn't raise the money. And that was in 1829. So you've got this half-finished monument. Over the years, what ideas have people come up with to complete this monument? Am I asking the right question?
as in, they were going to, what the finished building was going to look like, or what it was going to use
well,
for?
Well, it'd been abandoned and only half finished. So over the years, people thought, well, actually, we could make something of this.
Oh, what chip in? What chip in?
A chip in?
Spoons.
Spoons. Yeah,
actual affordable housing in Edinburgh. I bet you now, bloody student flats and new hotels.
Interesting ideas. It was proposed to make a monument to Queen Victoria when she died in 1901. Also, something to commemorate the 1707 Act of Union with England in 1907. Don't know why that wasn't popular.
Sounds like an English person thought that one.
Yeah, exactly. A new Scottish National Gallery in 1907, a Scottish Parliament building in 1908, and a memorial to those who fell in the Great War in 1918. How did Glasgow Council offer to help?
Pull it down.
No, even more canny than that. So, at one stage, the Glasgow Council offered to complete the monument, as long as its coat of arms could be visible. For some reason, Edinburgh declined. hence one of its other names, the Pride and the Poverty. And here's a little niche question for you. So where was a full-scale replica of the Parthenon actually successfully built and completed in 1897? One of our panellists got it right yesterday. I was amazed.
Any questions?
Las Vegas.
Well, we're in the right country. We're in the right country.
Yeah.
So I haven't got
your
answer.
Oh, I just said too much pressure.
Oh, too much pressure.
What was it in too much pressure? Wyoming.
Well, okay, it's Nashville in Tennessee.
Ah, that's of course.
And it was to celebrate the 100th anniversary of Tennessee.
I mean, that's one place I would not connect with.
Yeah,
Christmas.
But it's America. It's like London Bridge over nothing. Right, so this is a very long question, so let's try and take this in. What happened in 1916, which made the Keeper of the Great Seal of Scotland move the Regalia of Scotland from the Crown Room in Edinburgh Castle to one of the castle vaults?
Now, that's during the First World War, right?
Yes.
So I'm pretty sure they had German prisoners of war in Edinburgh Castle during the Great War. So I'm going to see a German plot.
A nasty German plot.
I mean, hey, a German plot, whether it was nasty or not, I'm not passing judgment.
It's the way you said it. It's the way you said it. Okay, a German plot. So any ideas over here? Any thoughts of the off the cuff? You're right when it comes to Germans, so I'll give you that. Yeah.
I'm not too sure.
Yeah. So it was after German air raids on the city, in which one bomb exploded near the castle. So it decided that the roof of the Crown Room was not bombproof, so the Regalia had better be moved for their safety. But what was novel about these air raids?
They were done from balloons.
Yeah, because it was Zeppelins.
Carried out by Zeppelins.
They also bombed Hartlepool, which is next to where I live.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. That's why I like this.
from Zeppelins?
Yeah.
All right, because it was also bombed, as was sort of going off track here, as was Scarborough and Whitby,
yeah,
from the battle cruisers as well, in 1916.
Right. So,
it's Edinburgh, so we'll stick to Edinburgh. So for about half an hour on the night of the 2nd to the 3rd of April 1916, two German airships, the L-14, and the L-22 dropped 7 incendiary and 17 high explosive bombs on Leith and the city of Edinburgh. 13 people died and 24 were injured. The White Hart Hotel in the Grassmarket and the County Hotel in Lothian Road suffered substantial damage, as well as a number of tenement buildings in Newington. A flagstone in the Grassmarket marks the spot where a bomb landed in front of the White Hart Inn, making a 9 by 6 foot crater. Well, I'm hoping my own fringe show in the Grassmarket can make as big an impact as I know. I had to get something. So, we've mentioned the White Hart Inn, or I have. Parts of the building date back to 1516. So the White Hart Inn is the oldest pub in Edinburgh and also claims to be the most haunted. I'm not sure about that, though. Because there's the Banshee Labyrinth, isn't there? But anyway.
Also, I thought the sheep's heat. Is that
what
I
meant? Yeah, so how do you prove what is the most haunted pub?
It's all like it's not real!
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Who stayed at the inn during his last visit to Edinburgh in 1791 and there bid farewell to his lover, Agnes Nancy McAlowes, before she left for Jamaica?
Ooh.
One of the ghosts?
In 1791.
Sir Walter Scott?
You're on the right lines, but...
My will to live? My will to live?
Your will to live, I'm sorry.
I know, I'm only joking.
No, so it was Robbie Burns. Nancy was the inspiration for which of Burns' poems?
The one about the pudding?
I'll be honest, I was about to say to Nancy, and then I realised what that could be inferred as, and I didn't mean that.
it was Aphon Kiss. He sent her a copy of the manuscript after their final meeting. So in 1803, William and Dorothy Wordsworth also stayed at White Hart while on their tour of Scotland, Given that the pub is in the Grassmarket, how do you think Dorothy described the pub in a kind of 19th century version of TripAdvisor?
A hive of scum and villainy. Mm.
It's a bit scary.
It's ghosts
everywhere.
Ghosts as well.
Not enough daffodils.
Doth the depths of hell have been brought upon the land?
Yeah, strangely enough, she said it was not noisy and tolerably cheap.
Tolerably cheap.
Not during
how times have changed, that's all I can say. Yeah. Right, new topic. Who was Greyfriars Bobby?
A wee dog.
A wee dog, yes. What brand of dog was he?
Scotty.
West Highland Terrier?
Oh, close, but we'll come back to that. He was a Skye Terrier dog. Born on 4th of May 1855. He became known for spending 14 years guarding the grave of his owner in the kirkyard at Greyfriars until he himself died in 1872. Bobby's headstone was placed by the Dog Aid Society at the kirkyard's entrance in 1981. What spot does this mark?
The spot where he had his last piddle.
That's what I was thinking. That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah. Weird thought to have.
I mean, I'm not saying I was excessively thinking about it.
It's a bit of a trick question because it doesn't mark any particular spot. But many visitors think, oh, well, that's obviously where the dog, or, and therefore his owner, must have been buried. But it's not, because Bobby's original grave was unmarked. Who owned Bobby? Who was his owner? Do you know anything about the story?
I must admit, I don't really know the guy. I feel like that says something about you if your dog is better remembered than you are.
Well, there are contradictory contemporary accounts, so there isn't any true answer, let's say. One has him owned by a night watchman and another owned by a farmer, but both were called John Grey. In 19th century Europe, there are over 60 documented accounts of graveyard or cemetery stray dogs who were fed by visitors and curators, to the point that the dogs made the graveyards their home. So people naturally came to believe that the dogs were there watching over a grave. And this story appeared in the Scotsman at the time, and visitor numbers increased to the graveyards, and people realised, oh, this is a way we can make money. Mm. Typical Edinburgh. I say that. They were making as a commercial benefit for the local community. So this author, called Jan Bonderson, recollects that in 1867, the original Bobby died and was replaced by a younger dog to keep the thing going, which explains why the dog seemed to have lived quite a long time. So in 1912, a novel called Greyfriars Bobby was published by the American author Eleanor Atkinson, and that popularised the story in the United States, and her version of the story is one which is most familiar to people today. Why is that surprising?
She never visited Scotland.
Exactly. She never even said what it was.
I thought I was given a joke answer.
And she embellished much of the story just from her own imagination. How did the English philanthropist Lady Burdett Coutts choose to commemorate Bobby after he died?
Oh, did she have him stuffed and put on her mantelpiece?
Sorry. I like the answer though.
A nice painting and a little suit. Yeah.
Do you have to think at this point?
Made into a burger?
No,
it's too far.
So oh, we're all hungry, we're all skipping.
No, I'm getting hungry. She commissioned a drinking fountain with an upper fountain for humans and a lower fountain for dogs, with Bobby statue on the top, and that's what you can see on Candlemaker Row at the top. The sculptor was William Brodie. So that was erected the year after Bobby's death, and you can see that at the, just near the graveyard's gate. What's unusual about this monument? Because we've all seen it.
Everybody keeps rubbing its nose.
Yep. Because?
Because people...
Because
people are sheeple. And they'll just follow what everybody else does. Somebody rubbed the nose and then they have to rub the nose. Although I've got a theory that it's actually the council's way of trying to clean the statue. it's the head now. It's the head now that you need to rub. There you go.
It's like the toe of
David
Hume. Yeah. Sorry, Tasha.
No, I was genuinely upset because I don't know if I'm just naive, but I thought that was an actual tradition that had been around for like a long time, and I found out it's been like a maybe 20-year thing, and it's made up from tour guides, and I was genuinely upset when I found that out.
Oh, So I'll tell you what's actually unusual about the monuments. It's Edinburgh's smallest listed building. So that's a fact you can take away with them. The drinking fountain's water supply was cut off, together with Edinburgh's other drinking fountains, around 1975 due to health scares.
Probably
so,
for the best.
Yeah. So nothing new in the health scares. What happened to the monument in 1984, which led to it being restored and reinstated the following year?
He got cancelled.
He was ahead of his time. Yeah.
Had to come back to Earth. Somebody painted over it.
Yeah, quite prosaic. It was hit by a car. Could have guessed anything there. And why was the 2006 film The Adventures of Greyfriars Bobby controversial? And this comes back to something I said at the start.
Oh.
So
they used the West Highland Terrier as a bridge to Skye.
Yes.
Oh.
Now this led to protests from the Skye Terrier Breed Club.
I love Scotland so much.
So Christopher Figg, the producer, said that a Westie was used because its white coat would stand out in the dark, and because its eyes would not be hidden from the camera by a fringe. And I checked this out yesterday, and I'm sorry to say this isn't true. But the sign at the kirkyard's entrance near to the dog's headstone is said to say, "No dogs allowed." Oh, I thought it was funny, but anyway. Can I not say that right? And I checked it yesterday and there is no sign there saying no dogs allowed, so it's not even true. So. Good, I might even cut that from tomorrow's show. Because I like to get a laugh, don't we all?
I think you just prefix with, "This is a joke."
Yes, get a laugh. Okay, right, new subject. Which of the many famous people buried in Greyfriars Kirkyard, sorry, of the many, who was William McGonagall?
He was the husband of Professor McGonagall from the Harry Potter series.
Oh gosh, right.
On his actual Wikipedia page, which I think is really, really sad, he's, quote, an extremely bad poet.
Yes, he's famous for being a bad poet.
That was my hero. In all fairness, though, if you read his poems, they are really bad. Just like, he does one, but it was like a Dundee.
I'll give you an example. Yeah. Yes. So he was an Irish-born Scottish weaver, actor, and extremely bad poet, which I think is a fair description, to be honest. And he moved to Edinburgh in 1895, which is why I can include him in the show. His only apparent understanding of poetry was his belief that it needed to rhyme. A great example was his poem about the Tay Bridge disaster. Yes. So it starts off. I'll try and give him credit here. Beautiful railway bridge of the silvery Tay. Alas, I am very sorry to say that 90 lives have been taken away on the last Sabbath day of 1879, which will be remembered for a very long time. You're impressed. That's not all nice. Modern sources give the death toll as 75. I need to point that out. Anyway, and the poem finishes, "I must now conclude my lay by telling the world fearlessly, without the least dismay, that your central girders would not have given way, at least many sensible men do say, had they been supported on each side with buttresses. At least many sensible men confesses. For the stronger we our houses do build, the less chance we have of being killed."
I think poems and songs do need more engineering advice. I enjoyed the tunes and I've learned something.
So yeah, rhyming buttresses with confesses was genius. On one occasion, his workmates paid a local theatre owner to allow him to appear in a title role in a production of Macbeth. How did that play go wrong in the final act?
He refused to die.
Yes. So he was convinced that the actor playing Macduff was jealous of him, and so he refused to die.
It's a shame.
Final piece on McGonagall. He died above what is now the Captain's Bar in Edinburgh's South College Street, penniless,
really?
In 1902. Yeah.
I'm glad that's the same for artists.
It's like Van Gogh. He was ahead of his time, possibly. Or behind his time, I'm pretty sure. Also buried in Greyfriars Kirkyard is someone called William Smellie. So who is he? believe that Tasha's been doing some Google searches.
Got my notes, yes. Yeah. So, an encyclopedist? I don't know how to say that word.
Yes.
He made encyclopedias and wrote them.
Yes. So he was born at the Pleasance in 1740, went to Duddingston and then the high school in Edinburgh. At the age of 12, he left school to become an apprentice printer. And at 26, he was hired to edit the first edition of the Encyclopaedia Britannica.
Mm.
Now, it's conceived as a reaction to the French equivalent by Denis Diderot, which was widely viewed as heretical and was inspired as part of the Scottish Enlightenment. So he was offered £200 to produce this encyclopaedia. And it appeared in 100 weekly instalments between 1768 and 1771, totaling 2,391 pages. It was priced at sixpence or eightpence if you wanted it on finer paper. His printing office was in Anker Close off the Royal Mile, now East Market Street, and his house used to be where George IV's bridge now stands. So he had to borrow ideas and facts from other authors. And his encyclopedia contained, therefore, gross inaccuracies and fanciful speculations. So a few questions about how you think he defined or described certain things in his encyclopedia. So, first of all, how do you think he described California, spelled with two L's?
Walk.
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 Yeah,
you're speaking Geordie now.
Walk.
I'll translate walk.
W-O-K-E.
Yeah. Your joke wasn't that funny, but you
I think I'm going to deal deeper into this.
Yeah, any other ideas?
California.
Walk?
Yeah.
It
will. Yeah, why not?
Yeah, yeah. Full of oranges and peaches.
Yeah.
That place over there.
Yeah, well,
dragons.
Yeah, described as a large country of the West Indies. No, no one's laughing. unknown whether it is an island or a peninsula. Yeah.
Well, that's true. Like, you look at old maps.
Well, yeah,
it's an island.
Yeah,
they didn't realise that it was actually attached to the mainland.
Yeah. What did he say excessive use of tobacco caused?
Well, I've smoked all my life,
yeah.
So it really improved your sex life. It really improved your singing voice, as you heard earlier.
I need to stop smoking, don't
I? Yeah, you should take it.
I think there was a lot of theory around time that it was good for the body, smoking. That it, like, the smoke would get rid of the bad in you, so that
that's
more
you
clean
your lungs. That's
like,
clean your lungs.
Yeah, I think it was like James VI, the King. He was like, he wrote this piece about how smoking is really bad and it's awful, and everybody was just like, this guy's an idiot.
I'll never catch on.
Don't you think that it caused your brain to shrivel up? It caused neurodegeneracy?
Oh, you've been looking at this one. Yes. So actually, he thought it dried up the brain to a little black lump consisting of mere membranes.
It probably does. That's
that makes sense for me. I can feel that.
Yeah. What did his article on woman say? Careful.
I will defer to other members of the panel.
That they would, I can't remember the exact wording, but they would not to men. I'm not sure, it was like, they aren't men, or the other version of men.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Four words covered it was the female of man.
Wow.
That's all you need to know, really. No.
What did you describe as a man?
Not a man.
You'll be flipping through, where are the answers?
It's a bit like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, it's like mostly horns. So. The first edition says that humans are divided into five categories. What might they have been?
Depressed, sad, unhappy, anxious, and liar.
Yeah,
so
that's just middle thing. You know,
yeah.
Sorry, Tasha, yeah.
I didn't want to Google this, so I thought it would make me too angry, so I stayed away from it generally.
Oh, okay. Fine.
It's
more than fine. So he came up with European, American, Asiatic, African, and Monstrous.
Ooh, I don't want to know who is.
That was a big friend, though.
Not nice. Edinburgh-born Andrew Bell produced almost all of the copperplate engravings for the first four editions of the Britannica. He was 4'6" tall, had crooked legs due to rickets, and an enormous nose that he would sometimes augment with a papier-mâché version whenever anyone stared at his natural nose. Apparently, apparently, I don't know. Can you believe what you read? I don't know. He deliberately rode the tallest horse in Edinburgh, dismounting by a ladder to the cheers of onlookers.
How did he augment his nose?
Paper mache.
Have you not done that before? Paper mache.
I don't know. He's like, I'm very sensitive about this. So what, did he add more nose and then that would cover it up?
I'm aware of the time, so I'll just say one last thing about him. So I mentioned Robbie Burns earlier, so he was a friend of Smalley. Robert Burns wrote a verse about him. Oh, I'm going to struggle with this one because I struggled with the one before. Shrewd Willie Smalley to the crocolin came, the old cocked hat, the brown surtout the same, his grizzly beard just bristling in its might, 'twas four long nights and days to shaving night. His uncombed hoary locks, while staring, thatched a head for thoughts profound and clear unmatched. Yet though his caustic wit was biting rude, his heart was warm, benevolent, and good. I think I prefer McGonagall myself. Right, conscious of time, so I'm going to have to skip over some of the things I was going to say. It just remains for me just to thank our guest today. Thank you so much for the research you put into this show. Paul Connolly, Epi Brilliant, and Tasha Moore.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank the Edinburgh Festival Fringe and the Hill Street Theatre for hosting us today. The next show will be at the Edinburgh Fringe tomorrow, 6th of August, in the same space at 10:45. Guests, very quickly, would you like to advertise your wares? What are you doing at the Fringe? We'll start with Tasha this time. Why not?
I've been told to advertise. I'm doing Rude Cookies, which is at the Leith Depot at 6:15 to 7:15, and I'm doing 14th and the 20th. And yeah, you get these cookies and you can get whatever you can write on them as a snack, so whatever you want.
Thank you. I'm just here to enjoy myself and get really drunk.
Excellent.
I am involved in a couple of shows. I'm not at every performance, but in the two shows I'm part of, one is Absolute Improv with Juice Improv. That's a short form improv, Suicide's Enemy style. It's on every day at the Space on the Mile at 7:45. And I'm also part of Spontaneous Potter, which is a fully improvised Harry Potter fan fiction. And that's on every day at 6:30 at the Stands Newtown Theatre. And you can find me on social media at Paul Connolly Actor.
Was it Actor?
Everywhere it's Actor. Twitter, it was, or X, whatever you want to call it, it was too long, so it became Act. But everywhere else, it's
paying attention. Yeah. Spontaneous Potter is very good, I can definitely recommend that. And I have my own solo stand up show in, 1 hour's time now, at the Beehive Inn in the Grass Market. If you like one liners and puns, it's called Short Joke Teller. It's 12:45 every day up until the 27th, except 16th. Got one very quick final one this day, which is another poet called Edmund Guest. He was born in Birmingham in 1881, and his family moved to Detroit when he was 10. Guest became known as the People's Poet before Rick Mile took on the same role. His poems often have an inspirational and optimistic view of everyday life. He died on this day in 1959. So here's a little poem again, but from Edward Guest. The man who wants a garden fair, or small or very big, with flowers growing here or there, must bend his back and dig. The things are mighty few on earth that wishes can attain. Whate'er we want of any worth, we've got to work to gain. It matters not what goal you seek, its secret here reposes. You've got to dig from week to week to get results on roses. Guest's poem, It Couldn't Be Done, was recited by Idris Elba on the BBC's Sports Personality of the Year Award in 2012, while celebrating Team GB and Paralympics GB winning the team award that year. Whereas Dorothy Parker reputedly said about Edward Guest, I'd rather flunk my Wasserman test than read a poem by Edward Guest. In case you don't know, a Wasserman test is an antibody test for syphilis. And on that note, goodbye.